right. Welcome back to the All Good in the Brotherhood podcast. I am the co-host, Tom Whitaker. Deacon Brother Francisco is out this week. But he's a deacon now, so he's got a lot of responsibilities that come with that.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah, he still having to do all the seminary classes, still having to do all that. And then, of course, Nate is down in Washington, D.C. at law school now. So
what a bozo.
I've heard law school keeps you a little busy, but I don't know. It could be fake news. You never know these days. What's one master's degree to another, right?
You know? What are classes?
Yeah, what's education? Why bother? Welcome back. Today, I'm with my good friend, Paul Henley.
Cheers.
We're going to talk about how friendships get us through periods of change in our life. So in last week's podcast, Brother Francisco, Deacon Francisco, and I talked about, do monks have midlife crises? And we talked about how life is kind of, in some ways, just one crisis to the next, you know, which is maybe seems a little bit of a pessimistic outlook, but it's kind of the reality. There's always something that we're experiencing that needs to move us into that next stage of life. We're always experiencing that change. And sometimes those changes aren't very fun, and sometimes they're hard. Sometimes they just straight up suck. We talked a lot about how living in the present moment is a key to maintain that interior peace. There's a lot of great literature out there about maintaining your interior peace. So today, though, we want to talk about less so how do you just sort of internally handle change, and talk a little bit more about how we do sometimes need to go external. And while prayer and engaging with the sacraments and all those things that we talked about are key to that, there's also just a natural point in time when leaning on a friend is what you need to do to kind of smooth out the edges of those changes in life and get through them without going crazy, I guess.
That's the goal, at least.
Yeah,
we don't all make it, but
yeah, that's true. Some of us just stay crazy. There's just a steady, unsustained craziness.
Yeah, you became crazy. I was born. Bane would say.
There you go. That's a very Bane way to look at it. So Paul and the Henley family in general have been long-standing friends of the Whitakers. Not just myself, but Deacon Francisco as well, and Nate.
Yeah. Was 2014 the first year we really were? Became close with you guys, or was there something before that?
I feel like I got to know your older brother, David, before that, because I know when I got to Family End that year to work Alumni Corps, David and I were already cool, David. I didn't know you quite as well, and I think that was the first time that I got to know you, really, because you were there at Service Corps.
Yeah.
And before we get too much further along, so we're talking again, as we have many times on this show, about Catholic Family End, the apostolate for family consecration. So they have, every summer, they have these week-long fests, and families come from all over the country, sometimes even the world. People come from other countries and stuff, too, to a small town in Ohio, Bloomingdale, Ohio, to spend a week with other Catholic families.
Yeah, and my brother-in-law affectionately calls it Catholic cult land, as someone who did not grow up going there, but he enjoys it. He enjoys seeing his kids smile, because it's a really good place to go meet other people.
Yeah. Yeah, because if you haven't experienced it externally, you'd be like, this place seems a little strange.
Yeah,
like a little on the edge there.
What do you mean? You want to spend your week of vacation going to a asbestos-ridden campground? Yeah, babe, let's do that.
A bunch of Catholic families who have 12-passenger, 15-passenger vans.
So we have to go to mass. We have to go to a talk. And we have to go to an hour-long rosary?
That's a lot of
babe,
prayer.
I want to go to the beach.
Yeah. That's the truth. We do sometimes be like, man, we just need a vacation. Family's not a vacation. But it is a place where we've made some really fast friendships. We were joking earlier, it's literally a breeding ground for friendships.
It's a place where friendship becomes lifelong partners with benefits.
And then they bring back little friends to go do the same thing, presumably. Eventually.
It is very Catholic, though, so the lifelong partners is technically called marriage, I
That's
think.
True. That's the phrase we were looking for.
Sacrament, yeah. Maybe? Covenant? I don't know.
Something
hard
like
hard
that.
To remember.
Yeah. Something in that ballpark. I can say the Henley family, Paul, in many ways in particular, has been a friend for me that has helped me sort out some kind of confusing stuff in my own life, whether it's just, oh, let's talk about it. I mean, Paul and I have also worked together. We have the benefit of not only kind of becoming friends for a decade, playing volleyball and all the other stuff, frisbee at Fantaland. But we've also probably worked together in totality closer to like four or five years. Yeah. At a couple different places. And, I mean, anybody who's in the workforce knows that there's just a lot of stuff that happens in an office. There's a lot of stuff that goes on when you work for this company or that firm or whatever. And, it can be tricky. There can be a lot of soul searching that comes with that. And, we've kind of had our fair share of that.
Well, there is something when you're in the metaphorical trenches of the workforce, like you're able to get your coworkers in a way that nobody else in your life can, you know, even your spouse does not necessarily get your work struggles like your coworkers do.
Yep.
So,
which is why people get weird phrases like my work wife or my work husband, which should die, by the way. Those are terrible terms and terrible ideas.
Yeah, hot take. You shouldn't have a work wife.
You should not have a work
not,
wife.
It's not it.
You should not have a work husband. Not a thing.
Not. It is not chef's kiss. Let that one go.
Chef's kiss. But yeah, so... yeah, first off, Paul, I'll just see. Do you have, like, if I had to pull on a thread from, like, growing up, like, our families together, like, any particular memories, family or otherwise, where you're like, oh, yeah, that was, like, a key Whitaker-Henley family moment or key, anything that comes to mind?
Yeah, from, like, nothing too young. I just remember, I think there was a couple years where you and my older brother, David, who's about your age, again, we referenced him, teamed up on volleyball. Your, mm-hmm. your spouses played together.
Yep.
And I would team up with Nate and Sam and mm-hmm. Sarah, your other siblings, and you guys would always kick the crap out of them. It's like, what the hey, man? Why do older brothers always gotta win?
That's true. That was the really key one was you guys wore the pink polos.
Yeah. We're Pepto-Bismol.
Team Pepto-Bismol. That was great. That was still, like, very competitive. Like, we both ended up in the finals, your team and our team. And yeah, of course, you know, my brothers are so competitive.
So
competitive. They're like, oh, you guys were targeting our sister. I'm like, no, dude, we're just playing volleyball. Okay.
And the funny thing is, if you knew Tom or you knew David, they weren't targeting Sarah.
We're just not that good.
Doesn't happen.
I was kidding. David's no, very good.
They're that good. They could do it, but they're gentlemen and scholars. If they win, they want to win, you know?
True story.
They don't want the other team to lose. They want to win.
Yep. But that's for me, I would actually say that was probably a pretty... Because, yeah, that was... Great. Both of our families came together, but we broke apart to make two separate teams. Mm-hmm. Tons of fun.
Yeah.
You know, it's all right. We gave our younger brothers, you know, just a little bit of a reminder of what the older brothers can do.
You gotta box your little brothers
every now and then. Yeah. So, but anyway, yeah. So I thought we could talk today, just maybe if we can think of a couple good examples of, you know, back to the topic, like change. Life has crises that come up all the time, you know, that can be through work, through your family, through childhood, you know, mm-hmm. plenty of growing through the teen years has its fair share of, what am I even doing here? You know, existential crises over even sometimes little things, but in our minds, they can be very big things. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I guess maybe for starters, do you have, like, any particular experiences? Maybe we'll start when we're younger. We could each kind of give some thoughts of, like, how a friend helped you disentangle, you know, some sort of emotion you were feeling or some sort of, like, you know, struggle or challenge you were feeling, again, through mm-hmm. through that period of change specifically.
Yeah. No, I mean, especially going back to when I was younger, my family is, you know, I don't think you should say this once you're, you know, three generations deep, and we're about three generations deep, but we're still culturally pretty German, you know, try not to express too much emotion, but... you know, I just remember as a kid, you know, everybody's parents impact them in different ways. Hmm. And everybody's parents have a better or worse relationship at different times. And I would say there were some stressful times in my parents' marriage where there's a good bit of fighting. And man, I just remember, I'm the fifth of seven, and my siblings would just show us what love was. You know, my older siblings, you know, we'd all go hunker down in the basement, and the older siblings would make it their job to distract the younger siblings.
Wow.
And I mean, just looking back, it was incredible the maturity that they showed and the intimacy that we had because they were willing to protect us in a way that wasn't necessarily their job, but, you know, not by your hand, but in your lap. You know, they picked up the gauntlet and they did what they were responsible for. And because of that, we all just had a great relationship. And, you know, going back to what you guys talked about last week, I'm not familiar, but I do know, like, what what will heaven be? It's relationship with God, right? It's the beatific vision. And, like, how do you get to know God in this life? Yeah, prayer is important, but if heaven is relationship, then we can experience God most closely in our relationship with others. And so it's like that act of self-giving from my siblings was like genuinely an encounter with the living God.
Wow.
Like, it is just incredible.
Yeah. Well, and the kind of neat thing that I like that you brought, like, yeah, the experience of heaven into that, because in heaven we find something eternal, and there's a certain stability that comes with that. You know, like an anchor that we can always hold to is this idea of, like, yeah, when we ascend to that beatific vision, to that eternal relationship, there won't really be change. You know, mm-hmm. So that's kind of almost what made me think is like a good friendship, a good relationship that is, you know, tying you to that what we hope to and expect to experience in heaven can get you through, you know, life. If life is unstable or unstable and there's all this change and there's all these mini crises, maybe large crises that pop up, you know, then what's going to keep us tethered to that peace, that interior mm-hmm. peace? And it, you know, it's going to be that relationship that can give us that premonition of mm-hmm. what heaven is like, the ultimate stability, you know,
mm-hmm.
and not to reduce heaven to just like some sort of, you know, yin yang, perfectly balanced. It's everything is peaceful, you know, because that's a very reductionist idea.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what I kind of heard in that was, yeah, just that there's something that can kind of rebalance you and, you know, mm-hmm. help you in those moments when, yeah, the world around you, maybe, yeah, with parents fighting or mm-hmm. or whatever it might be.
Well, in that, you know, when you get to experience it so young, it sets the stage for you when you get older too. Like, if you have people who have cared for you, my parents cared for me, my siblings cared for me, you just don't believe that everyone's out to get you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you believe everyone's out to get you, you have to play Machiavellian games. You have to play the power game.
Yep.
Because you're alone. But if you're a part of a society, you can play the relationship game. You don't have to play the power game.
Yeah. Wow.
And so when you hit struggles at work or in romance or whatever your struggles are, that can ground you in, oh, I have people who care for me, and this might not be going well right now, but it doesn't have to go well. I don't have to be in control all the time.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, no, that's pretty neat to just kind of think about that those two games, like you just described, the power game and the relationship game. And that kind of made me think a little bit of, you know, some of what I can't isolate to a specific incident in a way you didn't either. It was more probably kind of a childhood of maybe variations of that, you know. But yeah, like my friendships growing up, I can think of like two friends in particular. One's named Josh, the other name's Glenn. And the three of us were like, we were a little, you know, Tres Amigos, you know, Three Musketeers or whatever, if you want. And we got into plenty of trouble, and we did plenty of silly, stupid things. We liked to make movies when we were kids. We liked to make movies. That was always a fun thing. But I think one thing that we all had in common, when we were all homeschooled, so that's one thing, is the three of us were all homeschooled. And I think we kind of all experienced in different ways a sense of being alienated from maybe some of our public school friends. And we did have friends. It wasn't, you know, like they're two separate worlds, you know, like, you know, the Little Mermaid and the real world. It's like, it doesn't have to be that bad. But some people, it feels like that. And for us, we certainly felt it. We felt that the alienation that may not have always been even real. We just felt it. We perceived it. And I think with that feeling of, oh, I'm an outlier. I'm not like part of this norm, which in retrospect I'm very grateful for not having been part of that norm. I'm grateful to have been an outlier in that sense. But we all had that shared common experience, and through that I think all of the little crises that came with that is, you know, we were able to kind of hold each other through that, you know, whether it's, you know, some weird relationship thing. And this is growing up, you know, from tween age into teenage into high school, even going off into college and stuff like that. Very meaningful friendships. And I think that's, you know, one key aspect I think of a meaningful friendship is you got to kind of have shared experience in some way. Like, it's probably not going to come from like somebody who truly has no idea what you're going through. Like, the best friendship in that context, and we've talked about and I've talked about it, I think, on the podcast too, like some of the meaningful relationships I developed when I was in the Army. And like you said, even coworkers, like you said, coworkers get each other. You're like, you're in the trenches and you experience the crazy bosses and you experience the dumb assignments and the like, oh my gosh, how did this happen? Like, you know, you have that shared struggle leading to bonds and leading to unity. And that's where you develop those meaningful friendships, which kind of, again, I feel like we keep coming back to stability, and that's like a key thing is, of that friendship. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, totally. Well, and that's, I think one of the things that's hard as an adult, because I think all of us can admit it is harder to make friendships, especially deep friendships as an adult, than it is high school, college.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
And a part of that is, it's just hard to waste time as an adult. You know, you get a wife, you get a couple kids, you have a job.
What is wasting time?
Yeah, you're like, oh, I want to get together and talk about entrepreneurial ideas, or I want to get together and talk about the faith. But how often do you just get together and be like, hey, dude, you want to like go like hike a trail for a couple hours and just like talk about life? Like, you know, I think that's the big differentiator, because just in college, you spend hours doing nothing. You think you're being productive.
Yeah.
You're not being productive.
You're sitting in your dorm room just talking.
Yeah, I can think of three to four people in my entire college experience who I think were actually productive. The rest of us were just like joking around and
super true
and making deep friendships, and that's not a bad thing.
No. Yeah, dude, being comfortable wasting time with somebody is like, I feel like that reminds me of like Christopher Robin and Winnie the Pooh, and yeah, like, which is obviously like a, you know, a little bit of a childish idea, but just like there's something, like there's still something beautiful about that, about being able to be like returned to that point of where you can with innocence waste time, you know, with somebody. And that, yeah, as an adult, so that actually kind of springboards, I think, into the, so we, you know, growing up, teenage, whatever, you know, even in high school, there's just lots of changes that come with like preparing to be ready for adulthood. But once you're actually in adulthood, like, there's still plenty of change, but it's so different. You know, the changes are, like, you now have, hopefully, you know, you're kind of taking things with stride, you know, like, hey, get married, starting a job, having first kid, having second, third, whatever, you know, those, you know, as the kiddos come and all those things happen, like, you start recognizing the patterns, the changes, and maybe you can kind of prepare for that interior peace, and maybe you can be a little bit more resilient to those changes. But friendships still matter in a lot of that, you know. Mm-hmm. So if you kind of had to, you know, give an example or two, like, in, you know, Paul and I both now share the fun joy of being husbands and being dads. Mm-hmm. And I know even this last year, like, we both, you know, with things with our kiddos, we had some moments that were very scary, as an example, just with kiddos' health and whatnot. But yeah, I mean, anything that kind of readily comes to mind of, like, a deep or meaningful friendship and how that helped you get through, or even if it wasn't like get through it, like, oh, everything was fine, but just sort of, again, disentangle.
Yeah, man, I mean, if I struggle to answer this, it's because there's too many options to pull from, so let me think for a second.
We know so many dudes out in this area too, you know, Steven and the Joshes.
The Josh Epps.
Oh yeah, it's true.
Oh man, I mean, so, like you referenced, so my son, when he was about 5 months old, developed infant botulism, which is very, very not common. Not very many people get it.
Scary.
Like 3 in 100,000 infants get it a year or something like that. So we had no idea what was going on. Just eventually we took him to the ER, and we thought maybe it was an ear infection. You know, he's not eating. He doesn't seem very comfortable. He just got so lethargic. And like eventually he wasn't able to hold his head up, he wouldn't move, he wasn't able to eat at all, and so eventually they determined he had botulism, and we were in the hospital for another week. He was on oxygen pretty much that whole time, and it was scary, you know, first time parent, you know, I've always thought, you know, kids are resilient, they'll recover, and here I am staring at my kid who hasn't eaten in a week, hasn't taken a shit in like a couple weeks. And it's just like, God, am I going to lose my son? And thankfully, I didn't lose him. He's healthy.
Yeah.
He recovered much faster than most kids with botulism. Yeah. All the prayers were so felt. But it was just a show of support. Again, I have such a good family. My mom and my little brother were going to be in the area that weekend when we were there. And my mom spent a couple days with us at the hospital. Mm. And after she went back home, Grace's dad actually took a week off of work. and came out and just held Vinny, so I didn't have to take time off of work because I didn't have much time left to take off. And he helped Grace get some sleep. Grace and I both slept in the hospital for a week, and it was pretty tough. But then my older brother lived about a 10-minute walk from the hospital we were in, and he would bring over a deck of cards and a couple of sandwiches for us so we'd have some real food to eat. And just the camaraderie and the family that we had, my gosh, I mean, it just showed us, you know, what's really important in life, and that is relationship. Like, there's no amount of money I would have denied to save my son's life.
Yeah.
And there's no amount of money that I would give up to have a different family. Like, I love my family so much. And that was just such a, I've been talking for way too long, but such a centering experience for me of, I need to prioritize family.
Yeah. And I think that's like, you know, and we know a lot of families that have pretty good families, and we know a lot of families that, like, the relationships are pretty healthy with their parents and their siblings and stuff like that. And that's not the case for everybody. And sometimes that's far beyond their control. You know, sometimes there's almost nothing they can do about it. They can't repair things that maybe they didn't break. It kind of was broken from somebody else or through some other situation and, you know, but for the families that still have relationships, but maybe they need more time, more attention, more devotion, there's almost nothing that's going to beat that. You know, like, non-family friends are great.
Awesome.
They're awesome.
But friendships change. Friendships end. You know, friendships are for a season of life.
Yeah.
And it is a beautiful season when you have good friends. And hopefully you have some ride or dies, you know, who are with you for 10, 20, 30, 40 years. But you also have to acknowledge your friendships will likely end. Like, you work with people, you will not always work with them. You fish with people, you're not always going to fish with them.
Mm-hmm.
But your family, I mean, that hopefully is until you die.
Yeah, super true. Yeah, and that's, yeah, I think that's a good, you know, I like that both your, in childhood, you can see that your siblings were there. And then, yeah, in adult, and I think you even hit something that I hadn't thought about, which is just, like, in adulthood, you also, again, and this isn't the case for everybody, but you can kind of mature into a different relationship with your parents, you know, or your in-laws, you know, like you said. And you can see maybe aspects of friendship there that you never would have really thought were going to come about, you know, because it's just like, oh, wow, like, I can actually understand a little bit more of what they went through. Again, back to, like, commonness of suffering and kind of, like, being in the trenches. Oh, this is what mom and dad went through. Oh, wow. Okay, yeah. I can kind of get things a little bit more now than maybe I did as a 12-year-old or 13-year-old or whatever. So I think, yeah, friendships can even develop with your parents, you know. And we're obviously raised in pretty strong families, and I think growing up, you kind of, like, in families like ours, you can kind of pretty clear understand that, like, oh, mom and dad are not my friend. Like, they love me and they take care of me, but they're not my friend. Like, and that's okay. Like, they are, like, just like, you know, like a leader of a wolf pack. Like, somebody's got to do it, and somebody's got to make the decision. Somebody's got to enforce discipline, etc. Sometimes as a kid, you don't get it, and it's just how it is. But as you, I think, grow into adulthood, you can start understanding, again, more of what that is.
Well, and I think you can start to understand the imperfections more, too. You know, it's like when you're a kid, I love my parents to death. I'm not trying to shit-talk anybody.
Yeah.
But, you know, there was a lot of yelling when I grew up. You know, it wasn't a perfect home.
Yeah. None are.
Yeah, there are no perfect
except
homes.
For the Holy Family. But,
yeah. Yeah, even then, you know, St. Joseph's in, so there had to be some level of imperfection there.
You know, if something was done wrong.
What was it, Mother Angelica who'd say, it takes a saint to live with a saint? St. Joseph might not have been holy enough to really be married. Sorry, St. Joseph, my bad. You know, it's like, as you get older and you see the imperfections in yourself, I mean, it brings a lot of, I think, sympathy and empathy that you can have for your parents. And that can bring a lot of healing and forgiveness to just say, man, I had two parents who grew up, and they had parents who weren't perfect. And then they had to figure out finances, and they had to figure out life with seven kids, you know. And I think that's a part of the depth of the relationship is realizing, oh, that's just a dude.
Yeah.
Like, and he did the best he could raising me, and I want to honor that. And again, thankfully, my family, we don't speak our boundaries out loud, but we're pretty good at honoring boundaries. And I know not every family is like that. And my heart breaks for those families. Because without boundaries, you can't really have a healthy relationship.
True.
Whether it's within family or with friends.
Yeah.
If you don't honor each other's boundaries, like, it's not really a friendship.
Yeah. Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Wow, that's cool. I feel like you said a lot, and I'm still trying to, like, figure out the... No, not in a negative way. Like, you just said, you just spoke a lot of truth there. And I just think that's really inspiring, too, because, yeah, I think, especially as you start having kids, there's also a natural tension that can kind of build of, like, you know, as a young parent, you have to set standards in your own home. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even for those of us with good parents and good homes, we still may make commitments at times to, like, well, I know this is how my parents did things. And again, not talking bad, but, like, I know that I want to do things a little differently. Like, I feel like maybe they didn't understand how this particular way or this particular way that they talk, this particular way that they did things impacted me as a child. And I can kind of see in myself that some of that may have had effects later on down the line as I grew into adulthood. So you're going to make those commitments as a young parent to maybe do things, well, a little differently here and there. And that can come with a little bit of natural, like, well, why are you doing it that way? You know, like, you know, why are you having your grapes instead of quartering them? You know, or like, whatever, you know. So.
It's like, why is this the argument we have to have?
Yeah. And I just, but like, stuff like that, you know, like, little things to big things, that there will be those, like, a little bit of friction. But I think even those things can still be done in a healthy way. Some young parents, I feel like they have a little too much trauma from childhood, from the way things that they kind of want to put walls up there, and they just like, yep, mom and my parents are not even part of this decision cycle at all. There's no input here at all.
And that's a boundary. That's a reactionary boundary, right? Mm-hmm. Of,
yep.
I don't trust mom and dad. Mom and dad won't honor what I have to think. So I don't want to hear what they have to think either.
Yeah.
And sometimes that's necessary, but again, that's heartbreaking because it's not severing the relationship, but in another sense, it is severing the relationship.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
saying, I don't want to hear it, mom. Shove it.
Hmm.
And sometimes, again, sometimes it's necessary, but if it's necessary, that is sad. I'm sorry that people have to go through that.
Yeah. And that's hard. Like, yeah, it's tragic when, and we know some friends, you know, at least I can think of some, who have had to make those kind of more dire and finalistic decisions of like, hey, this relationship only leads to suffering or struggle. You know, especially when those, you know, relationships, not, this isn't just parents, you know, but like relationships in general, like you said, start driving wedges between like husband and wife, or, you know, dad and son, and, you know, dad and daughter, and mom and son, mom and daughter. When those relationships start becoming a little bit fractured at the edges because of another relationship, again, they're not respecting boundaries. So there's many ways, just like meaningful relationships can invigorate you through all those periods of change and those struggles. Toxic relationships, which is a term thrown on probably a little bit casually, but we'll use it in this case. Toxic relationships do the exact opposite. Mm-hmm. They can undermine, they can create instability, they can create lack of peace. And this kind of makes me, I'll circle in back to the work thing. So again, yeah, Paul and I had shared in the trenches of a couple different institutions that we've worked at, and there's a lot of good that we can say about them too. You know, we're not going to sit here and just be like, everything's bad, but I will fully admit that, like, I'm the type of person that I struggle to create my own boundaries probably in work. I'm much more inclined to try to accept more than I should, and in some ways maybe develop even, like, relationships in ways that maybe within the context of the workplace aren't always, like, the most prudent. Not in, like, a weird way, but just, like, maybe you went a little too far here or there, you know?
Specifically... probably friendship.
Yeah, friendship, you know, type. Yeah,
friendship type relationships.
Exactly.
To clarify.
Yeah, just
in case anyone was wondering.
I'm not that kind of a coworker. But
Tom is a great coworker. Yeah. Tom does not say no in the workplace very often.
True.
When it comes to tasks.
Too much of a people pleaser, I think, is a struggle I've had in the past, and that lends itself to just putting myself out there, and then sometimes being, when you're vulnerable like that, being kind of wounded.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Paul is an example of somebody who's kind of helped me over the years see that and, like, take, in a lot of ways, I always thought that was a strength of mine, being able to be like, you know what, I'm willing to be vulnerable to the point of my own insecurity because I'd rather have, like, the value of that friendship, that relationship or whatever, and then just not have it at all and never risk it for the biscuit, kind of. But I think, again, within the context, I feel like everyone, Paul's helped me understand, as well as other relationships with other coworkers too, that there are healthy boundaries within like the context of the workplace. Just like it's okay to have healthier but expanded boundaries at, you know, in your just community. Like, okay, hey, this is my, you know, workplace, and yeah, I'll strive to have relationships with these people. It's going to come naturally because we're experiencing the same mission. There's a unifying factor there. But hey, now in my church or in my neighborhood, etc., like, there's just, it's a different context. And I think it can, yeah, it can just be helpful to even have a good friendship help you be a better friend within that appropriate, you know, context. So sometimes, you know, a buddy might be like, look, you know, you're kind of spinning your wheels here with this thing you're doing in life, whether it's another relationship. Stop barking up that tree. Ain't nothing gonna change. Like, you know, learn, you know, recognize the signs, you know, develop the social awareness to like recognize when you need to, you know, not quit, but just like not extend yourself to a point of instability.
Totally. Well, and that's, I think, you know, having wise counsel, having good friends, they recognize when you're spiraling, you know, and they can bring you back to life. Because I think all of us probably alternate. We have two voices in our mind, you know. We have one that is too generous. Oh, I don't feel like it today. I'm just going to, like, sleep in. And the other one is, I suck. I have to work so hard to make up for the fact that I'm just the worst. And, you know, obviously those could be extremes, and we all have one of those more than the other. But when you have friends who can see, hey, man, you've been burning the candle at both ends, you need to take a break, that's so helpful. Or even, you know, let's say you get fired. You know, how easy is it for you to counsel someone who got fired and say, hey, man, like, this isn't the end of the world, you're going to get back up.
Yeah.
But that person in it, he can't take that bird's eye view.
That's true.
You know, it's like, this is the end of the world, I'm never going to be able to find another job.
Yeah.
And so to have a good friend who can say, no, man, you're going to be okay.
Yeah.
Like, reset.
Yep.
And then let's get after it.
Yeah.
That's life-changing.
That's true.
And we've seen some shootings in the past few weeks and some murders. I just got to wonder, for the people who are doing those things to children, to adults, to whoever, what if they had a good friend who was just like, hey, man, I care about you way too much to let you do this. Like, this isn't healthy. We need to get you help.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's great. You know, it's so funny. And this is kind of what you just hit on. It's like, is why relationships are so powerful. And why, like, what we're built for, what we're literally made for, is for relationship, the ultimate relationship with our Lord. Like, that's what we're always looking for. You know, like, is it Lewis that says, C.S. Lewis says something like, even a man going to the prostitute is ultimately looking for God?
It sounds like Chesterton, but I'm not
maybe
sure.
Chesterton, okay, yeah. But the kind of in between the lines that I read is like, the person looking for a relationship, and barking up the wrong tree in that case, for sure. But I remember this crazy statistic from this there's this researcher that interviewed like 2,000 terrorists or something like that, people that belong to terrorist, like, officially designated terrorist organizations. And the most common, you know, we have all these things where we think, oh, they join this or that because of, you know, money, or, you know, in some cases religiosity, etc., fanaticism, etc., ideology. But the number one, the most common, was they all wanted friendships. They all saw in these groups people that they wanted to have relationships with.
That's why cults love bomb people, right? Yeah. Like, that's a classic.
Yeah. And it's just, we're all looking for friendship, and we're looking for relationship. And, you know, again, having those meaningful ones are the ones that are going to ground us and root us so that we continue to walk with stability towards heaven, as opposed to
Well, because, again, it's like, if heaven is relationship with God, hell is the lack of relationship with God. Like, evil is the depravity of the good. And so, like, isolation truly is hell on earth. Like, I don't know another way to say it.
Yeah.
And the deeper you go into isolation, the worse the outcomes get. You know, you go down the pathway to radicalization. Isolation is what step in that? First, second?
Oh, yeah.
Like, it gets dark quick.
Mm-hmm.
And how could it not if you're living in hell?
Yeah, it's the critical path towards, you know, being in a mindset which you're likely to harm yourself or others, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the things I've noticed on the rise, and this kind of always breaks my heart a little bit, is sort of the rise of people that have now purposefully chosen to select people other than human beings as like their primary friends. You know, like the people that have the tell your dog I said hi bumper stickers and the the fur baby types that, you know, they don't want kids and they don't really want friends. They want dogs, you know, they want cats. And I love pets as probably as much as the next person, maybe a little bit less so actually. But anyway,
I love them less.
Racy dogs is like a security function. I want somebody to help me fight somebody.
Tom has like 20 or 25 pit bulls around the yard. It's crazy the amount of dog turds in the yard.
But these people that like actually believe, and not only like believe it internally, but like profess that they believe like pets, animals are better friends than humans. That's the result of too many relationships which have people having respective boundaries, etc. But don't give up. Like I would just, if there's any of those types of folks listening, like, don't give up on real friendships. Like, don't substitute a creature or anything. It doesn't just have to be pets. There's so many ways we choose to, like, get into relationships or have some sort of, you know, AI nowadays. People that are talking to AI, and they think that their AI is their friend.
So did you see the news story of, there's a kid got killed, and it was tragic, just super tragic, but his parents made an AI version of him and had that bot interviewed on live TV. And it was just like, man, how could you ever go through the grieving process if you're interacting with this version of your son that just lets you live in denial?
Oh my gosh.
Talk about something that's demonic. I think oh, yeah, that's bad.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. This AI thing's scary. Scary stuff.
But I think the other thing for, you know, especially if you have been hurt by a lot of people, what I would do if I was trying to build good friendships is I would find someone who loves me for me, and then I would learn from them. You know, because if you've had a lot of bad relationships modeled to you, you're not going to know how to have a healthy relationship, right? You're going to live in that belief of playing the power game, not the relationship game. Then they're going to leave me anyways, I need to use them. Yep. And it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, because if you're just using your friends are going to leave you.
Yep, they'll detect it.
Yeah.
Those people can.
Yeah. It might take a week, it might take months, it might take years, but if you're just using your friends, like, they're going to leave. And then you're going to be reinforced in that idea that everyone's going to leave. So don't use your friends, learn from them.
Yeah.
If someone knows how to give of themselves for your good, learn how to do that from them. And that's hard to do, but that's the path to fulfillment. That's the path to relationship.
Yeah. This reminds me, a good friend of ours, so Paul and a couple other guys, about every other week we'll do like a morning coffee thing, and we will do coffee. We'll have coffee and we'll do office, large of the hours. And we'll talk for probably about half an hour or so, just kind of go around robin real quick, going on in life. A quote that's actually stuck with me for a while was, and I think Stephen Young, brought it from something he read, but it was like, you are like the average of the five people that you consider like your closest friends. I'm paraphrasing some way, shape, or form. And I remember like thinking about that one for quite a bit. Like, I think that's probably pretty true. Like, and not just in this average sense of like, oh, you know, I have two baseballs instead of three baseballs, right? And so, backyard baseball reference.
Pablo Sanchez.
Yeah, Pablo Sanchez had the most baseballs. If you've never played backyard baseball, I'm very sorry. You don't get that at 15 all.
15 baseballs. 15 baseballs is a lot of baseballs.
That's a lot. Yeah, Pablo Sanchez, what a player, man. Yeah. Pete Wheeler, just total stud, too.
Yeah, I mean, he should have had seven baseballs just for speed. He was twice as fast
as he was. He really was the fastest. So, like, he had the same as other people, but he was always fastest. Anyway.
Well, what a rabbit hole.
Yeah. Backyard baseball, it's great. Anyway. Oh, man, that's completely derailed my train of thought.
I don't know where
comparison. Okay. So, you know, that phrase, you are the average of, like, the five people closest to your five closest friends, etc. It's not about a performance comparison. It's though about like, what am I learning? Like you said, what am I learning from my five closest friends about, you know, if for me, like how to be a better dad, how to be a better worker, how to take care of my home, manage my finances, etc. Mm-hmm. You know, just, you will learn and that will enrich you, you know. Mm-hmm. Part of that comes with humility. Like, you can't be so prideful that you're like, I'm not gonna learn anything from anybody. Like, that's obviously the wrong mentality.
Let's just put this out there. You are not the shit. I am not the shit. None of us are perfect.
Yep.
We all have to learn from people. And again, I think one of the, you know, that coffee group, one of the things I learned from it is just how to be in relationship.
Yep.
Because again, like, that's what we're all striving to do, you know. At least, you know, if this is a Catholic podcast, we're all trying to learn how to be in relationship with God. And to do that, you have to be in relationship with others.
Yeah.
Like, I will say, I've learned more about God's love through marriage, even though, you know, I think I have a ketchup bottle older than my marriage, than I did from any other relationship.
That's such a funny thought picture.
Yeah. It's kind of funny.
My ketchup is older than my marriage, but I like my marriage a whole lot more.
I do like my marriage a whole lot more, but, yeah, because it's like, man, when you live with someone, you see their dark side, they see your dark side.
Exactly, exactly.
And you choose to love each other, and that's... Again, that just teaches you how God loves you. Because we all sin, we all fall short, and God chooses to love us anyways.
Right on. So, I think my final thing, just to circle a little back, was, yeah, like, find... When you said... Before you said, learn from a friend, you said, find somebody who loves you as you are. And I think that is... Like, that's the closest thing to, like, godliness. And to, like, when you think about your friends, your kids, your wife, like... And you're fully aware of... the struggles, you know, that in my case, my kids, my wife, your wife, etc. Like, we become fully aware of that. But it's not that we sort of love in spite. We just love. We simply love. Just remember that there are people that want to do that for you, too. It's hard to do that because you never... I don't really know anybody that, like, I really, truly love myself and I take care of myself fully, love everything about myself. Most people aren't that way. Most people are like, I really don't like this aspect of myself, one way, shape, or form.
You just don't have enough extroverted friends.
Yeah, that's true. Or enough narcissist as friends, I suppose. yeah, just remember that that's, like, the way that you want to extend love is the way people want to extend love to you. Mm-hmm. And that's how we should also understand a relationship to God. God wants to extend all that love for you, the ultimate friendship, the ultimate relationship. So, yeah. By healthy relationships that love us as we are, we can learn about our relationship with God, too.
Yeah. So, I think probably my last thought would just be, you know, when my wife and I were dating, I had to explain to her, because, again, my wife likes herself, she loves herself. I didn't like myself for a long time. Before that, I didn't love myself. I got to a point of loving myself before I got to a point of liking myself. So, like, if that's you, don't feel alone.
Yeah.
Yeah, don't take your own life. Don't hurt yourself. Go find someone who can teach you how to love yourself, who can teach you how to like yourself, because that's a hardship. But you will grow in holiness, and you'll grow closer to others if you can learn to treat yourself like you treat somebody else. So,
yeah, and get married, and stay married.
Or, yeah,
you know, if you're called to a vocation like Deacon Francisco, I guess you can go that route. I guess. No, I'm just kidding.
I guess. I don't know. It's the higher call, but
it's
whatever.
It's the higher calling, I guess. Whatever. No, hey, thanks for joining, Paul. Thanks for chatting on the All Good in the Brotherhood podcast.
Happy to be here.
Yeah. I hope everybody has a good rest of your week. And, yeah, you can do the, I don't know how Brother Francisco does it, but you can subscribe and like and comment and all those other things that people do on the social medias that I no longer really partake in, but apparently I still podcast. So, yeah, God bless. Peace out.
Peace out, homies.